And now it's time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use. Uncle Dennis here at Free Radio Santa Cruz on Thursday, April 14th. I'd like to ask you to have another pencil and paper handy so you can take down names, addresses, telephone numbers, web pages, all the information you need to take action. Let's start with announcements. The Alameda Creek Volunteer Earth Day Restoration will be taking place in Niles, California on April 17th. Join us for a morning of habitat restoration along Alameda Creek in Niles to celebrate Earth Day, Sunday, April 17th, from 10 a.m. to noon. We'll focus on removing invasive ivy and on maintaining the native plants our volunteers put in the ground at our Niles Adopt-A-Spot earlier this year. Your efforts will continue past work by volunteers and enhance habitat for fish and wildlife along Alameda Creek for years to come. Meet at 10 a.m. at the Niles Staging Area parking lot along Old Canyon Road near Canyon Oaks Court in the Niles area of Fremont. The approximate address is 720 Old Canyon Road. They'll work till about noon, and you'll need to RSVP at the website alamedacreek.org. They ask you to wear long pants, sturdy closed-toe shoes that can get dirty. Please, no sandals or flip-flops. We provide gloves and tools. The work isn't much on a slope, but the ground can be uneven. There is no poison oak in the immediate area where we'll be working. Expect cool weather and morning dew when we start. Heavy rain will cancel. All participants need to have a signed waiver form, and please go to the website for those details at alamedacreek.org. And anyone under 18 needs a parental signature. For the required RSVP and waiver forms, please go to the website www.alamedacreek.org. That's the Alameda Creek Earth Day Restoration, Niles, California, April 17th at 10 a.m. And the Elliott Rainforest Climbing Camp will be held April 19th through the 24th in Oregon. This is an event we have announced earlier. If you don't know about it, you should probably go and send an email to ElliottClimbCamp2K16@gmail.com. That's ElliottClimbCamp2K16@gmail.com. And you can find more information at theearthfirstjournal.org/newswire. The Coastal Watershed Council is presenting their 17th annual Snapshot Day on May 7th from 8 a.m. to 12 noon. Come join the Coastal Watershed Council and the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary for the 17th annual Snapshot Day event taking place on Saturday, May 7th. Do you care about your local stream? Do you care about the health of the ocean? If you answered yes to either or both of those questions, then we need you to help us collect valuable water quality data during this amazing event. The Community-Based Snapshot Day event provides the annual snapshot view of the health of our rivers and streams that flow into the Monterey Bay. In partnership with the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary and hundreds of community volunteers, we systematically sample stream water throughout the central coast of California. Participants will need to be trained and set up into teams to record valuable water quality data such as temperature, dissolved oxygen, electrical conductivity, pH, and transparency. You'll also learn how to collect water samples for laboratory analysis of bacterial indicators such as E. coli and total coliform, and nutrients such as nitrate and orthophosphate. There will be trainings prior to the event, but the training dates have yet to be determined. If you want more information, call 831-464-9200. The number again, 831-464-9200. Or go to the website, www.coastal-watershed.org. That's coastal-watershed.org. The 17th annual Snapshot Day is May 7th from 8 a.m. to noon. And eco-prisoner Rebecca Rubin has been released in this story from the Earth First Newswire. Rebecca Rubin has been released and moved into a halfway house. Sentenced in 2014 to 5 years in federal prison for numerous Earth Liberation Front and Animal Liberation Front actions, including the arsons at the Vail Ski Resort and U.S. Forest Industries, as well as liberating horses from and burning down the BLM's wild horse facilities in California and Oregon, Rebecca is out of prison almost a year and a half before an expected release date in September of 2017. We're glad you're out, Rebecca. Don't forget, Rebecca's birthday is on April 18th, so please stay tuned for more information about Rebecca's situation, mailing address, and ways to provide support. Rebecca will likely still want to receive mail at the halfway house, and I guess you're going to have to get more information about that at the Earth First Journal Newswire. That's www.earthfirstjournal.org/newswire. A log loader has been sabotaged in British Columbia in this story from the Earth First Newswire. According to Western Canadian Timber Products Limited, one of their 209 Hitachi log loaders was sabotaged near Mission, British Columbia, outside Vancouver recently. The alleged sabotage took place sometime during the evening or early hours of April 11th and 12th. During the night, the timber company stated, "Someone proceeded to cut a locked gate at our logging location in the Patterson Creek Road area. That person then placed a rock on the travel controls and proceeded to direct the log loader over the bank." You can see a picture of it at the Earth First Journal's Newswire. The company went on to remark that the destruction of this machine has cost our company greatly. To our knowledge, no one has taken credit for the action. You can find more information at theearthfirstjournal.org/newswire. And in news from Germany, a fox has been freed from captivity in this story from Biteback, as found on the Earth First Newswire. The Animal Liberation Front freed a fox from a hunting dog training facility in Kleinschnien, Germany, on March 26th. A structure was also set on fire. The activist wrote, "The members of the club should expect that we will continue to watch them. We urge them to immediately announce the closure of the facility so that no other foxes are deprived of their liberty. To rob them of freedom and to abuse them as training tools for dogs is not acceptable for us." Foxes were freed from a similar facility in Hildesheim, Germany, in June and December of 2015. That facility stopped operating after the actions. And this news came from the earthfirstjournal.org/newswire. Here's the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field. Buffalo Field Campaign patrols spotted the first baby buffalo of the season in the Hebgen Basin on Wednesday morning. The little one is doing well, as is mom. They are both safe from government harassment as they are on their newly granted year-round Horse Butte habitat. Thank you. Our new highway signs have arrived. Thank you so much for making it possible for us to get them. They are huge, heavy-duty, reflective orange signs and carry the most immediate message, Buffalo on the road. Wednesday morning's patrols were the first to use them in the field. Our well-worn hot pink signs will now be used mostly for night patrols, as transportation officials have declared the hot pink color is for emergencies only, and wild bison on a high-speed highway in the dark of night almost certainly qualifies. Unfortunately, a disgruntled local has vandalized two of the signs, but we're hopeful we can fix them and continue to use them. Our roving patrols continue to be extremely busy along U.S. Highways 191, 287, sometimes 24 hours a day, helping to warn traffic. We are pleased to report that since our last update, no vehicle collisions with buffalo have occurred. Warm days and rain have helped melt a lot of snow, so buffalo are able to access much more grass than they were just a week ago. Close to 200 buffalo are now on or making their way towards Horse Butte, with many still heading this way, still needing safe passage across highways from Montana. On the other day, we were greeted with the presence of four pregnant buffalo right in our front yard. Before last week, these buffalo would have been in what the Interagency Bison Management Plan considered Zones 3, or Zero Tolerance Land. The Montana Department of Livestock has never dared to haze buffalo off of our place, but now the buffalo are allowed to be there. It's a new awakening every day to see buffalo in places where once they would have been targeted with cruel hazing, knowing that they should be all right now in these areas. Our main area of concern is along the Madison Arm Road, which leads to the South Fork of the Madison River and Denny Creek. This land has now been completely taken away from the buffalo, yet it is important habitat that they greatly favor. There's still a lot of snow in this area, so buffalo are not accessing it yet, but when they do, we know the hazers will come to chase them away. The south side of the Madison is one more small but significant piece of ground that we must gain for wild buffalo. Meanwhile, in Gardner, Montana, all but two mature bulls have left the basin, moving into their calving grounds in Yellowstone's interior. With the governor's decision now in place, mature bull buffalo also have year-round access in the Gardner Basin. There again, we have much work to do in gaining the same rights for the matriarch-led family groups. We will forever defend wild migratory buffalo and their right to freely roam their ancestral lands. The Buffalo Field Campaign's website is www.buffalofieldcampaign. They have a tremendous amount of information there about wild bison in the United States and the things that they need to help the buffalo. When you figure out what that is, send it to the Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. That is Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. Any questions, give them a call at 406-646-0070. That's 406-646-0070. And again, all this information and more can be found at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And please remember, the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And the Supreme Court has denied efforts to overturn the Tongass National Forest protections in Alaska in this story from Cascadia Wildlands. The U.S. Supreme Court has declined to hear a last-ditch effort by the state of Alaska to exempt America's largest national forest from the national rule protecting underdeveloped, road-free national forest areas from logging and road construction. The state sought to overturn a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruling that kept the roadless area conservation rule in effect in the vast Tongass National Forest in southeast Alaska. The Ninth Circuit agreed with a federal district court in Alaska that the Bush administration improperly exempted the Tongass from that landmark conservation measure. The Tongass roadless rainforests are a national treasure and the last best intact wildlands in our bioregion, said Gabriel Scott, Alaska legal director for Cascadia Wildlands. We are pleased with the court's decision and the recognition that it is a privilege, not a burden, to conserve these national treasures for future generations. A coalition including the Organized Village of Kakeh, a federally recognized Alaska Native tribe, tourism businesses, and conservationists joined the federal government in arguing to the Supreme Court to leave the lower court rulings intact. This court order is great news for southeast Alaska and for all those who visit this spectacular place, said Earth Justice Attorney Tom Waldo. The remaining wild and undeveloped parts of the Tongass are important wildlife habitat and vital to local residents for hunting, fishing, recreation, and tourism, the driving forces of the local economy. The Supreme Court's decision means the America's biggest national forest, the Tongass, will continue to benefit from common sense rules that are applied nationwide. It feels terrific to put this case to bed once and for all, added Neil Lawrence, senior attorney and Alaska director for the Natural Resources Defense Council. Punching clear cuts and logging roads into America's last great rainforest wildland produced nothing but controversy, conflict, and uncertainty. The region can now move ahead on a path that benefits from and sustains the fabulous natural values that attract people to the Tongass, and all Americans can celebrate knowing that we'll pass on the crown jewel of national forest to future generations as wild and beautiful as it is today. Southeast Alaska has moved on, said Buck Linda Kugel, grassroots attorney for the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council. Clear-cutting old-growth forests in the remote wildlands of our region with expensive new logging roads no one can afford to maintain is a thing of the past. We are pleased to see the Supreme Court put this issue to rest and call on the state of Alaska to do the same. The Supreme Court's decision is a victory for wildlife in the Tongass National Forest, the state of Alaska, the region, and the nation, said Peter Nelson, senior policy advisor for federal lands for Defenders of Wildlife. The roadless rule protects the wildlands that form the heart of America's largest national forest within the most expensive temperate rainforest in the world. Future generations will now have the opportunity to experience the majesty of this ecosystem and the salmon, bears, wolves, birds, and myriad of wildlife that depend on it. The roadless rule protects our intact ancient forest that salmon, bears, and wolves depend on. Alaska's temperate rainforest is a treasure, and the decision will help keep the Tongass protected from more logging and destruction, said Mark Fink, senior attorney for the Center for Biological Diversity. We're pleased to see the roadless rule upheld again. Over the past decade, we've seen that the rule works. It has protected millions of acres of forest across the country, ensuring that both wildlife and American families have space to live and explore. In the face of a rapidly changing climate, protecting forests like the Tongass is even more important, said Allie Harvey with the Sierra Club's Our Wild America campaign in Alaska. It's common sense to protect this wild national icon for future generations to enjoy. And here's a little background information on the Tongass and the roadless rule. The so-called roadless rule was designed to protect large, relatively undisturbed landscapes in national forests from logging roads and clear cuts, while allowing other economic development, including hydropower projects, transmission lines, tourism, federally financed public roads, and even mining, to continue. The ruling is good news for the many residents of the region and local businesses who use and depend on the Tongass's outstanding natural values, as well as visitors who come to see America's last great rainforest, teeming with fish and wildlife that thrive in its undeveloped roadless areas. Little practical change is expected, however, since even when the Bush-era exemption was in effect, cost and controversy kept almost all logging out of roadless areas. And last year, a federal advisory committee, including representatives of the timber industry and the state of Alaska, formally and unanimously recommended against further logging of those wildlands. The 17-million-acre Tongass spans 500 miles of coastal southeast Alaska, encompassing alpine meadows, deep fjords, calving glaciers, dense old-growth rainforests, and over 1,000 islands and inlets. After much debate and hundreds of thousands of comments in 2001, the Agriculture Department decided that the roadless rule should apply to the Tongass, but included special measures to blunt the impact of the rule on Alaska's timber industry. Not applying the rule, the department found, would risk the loss of important roadless values in the Tongass. When the Bush administration reversed course and tried to exempt the Tongass from the roadless rule, it relied on factual findings at odds with those that justified its original decision and ignored the economic mitigation package for the Tongass. It asserted, without support, that the rule was not needed to protect Tongass wildlands and would cause widespread economic hardship. The Ninth Circuit's ruling and the decision by the Supreme Court not to review that ruling reinforced the settled rule that federal agencies cannot arbitrarily change policies and ignore previous factual findings simply because a new president has taken office. And for more information, go to www.cascwild.org. That's www.cascwild.org, the website for Cascadia Wildlands. And the United States has banned almost all Pacific sardine fishing after a population crash. In this story by Courtney Sherwood, with editing by Sharon Bernstein and Andrew Hay, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. Federal fishery managers have banned nearly all sardine fishing off the U.S. West Coast for the second straight year in a move hailed by conservation groups as key to protecting decimated California sea lion herds. Pacific sardine populations have plunged by 90% since 2007, prompting the Pacific Fishery Management Council to vote to extend its prohibition on virtually all fishing of the small oily fish within 200 miles of the California, Oregon, and Washington coasts. The sardine collapse has rippled up the food chain and has been linked to the deaths of sea lions and brown pelicans across the U.S. West Coast. Sea lion pups, emaciated and starving, have washed up on California beaches. Their mothers can't find enough food and have to search further and further for longer and longer periods of time, said Ben Entenap of Portland-based environmental advocacy group Oceana. The El Niño ocean warming phenomenon, as well as normal multi-decade ocean cycles, are factors in the decline of the sardine population, said Entenap, whose nonprofit is urging regulators to adopt a longer-term approach to addressing sardine populations. Climate change may also play a role, he added. If you are fishing that population too hard as it is crashing, the science shows that it will drive those populations down even more quickly, he added. Michael Milstein, a spokesperson for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, said the Fisheries Council had already started restricting sardine harvest before imposing a near moratorium last year, and that those early efforts may be paying off. There are some indications that large numbers of sardines did spawn successfully last year, Milstein said, but we won't know what difference that makes until those juvenile fish survive for a few more years. Most sardines caught off the U.S. West Coast are sold into global commodity markets, either canned for human consumption or sold as feed for penned tuna, with very little sold fresh in local markets, Oceana said. The moratorium on sardine catching includes exceptions for limited fishing by the Quinault Indian Nation and for small numbers of sardines accidentally caught alongside other fish. And in this story from Japan, radioactive boars are running wild around Fukushima reactors. In this story by Richard Lloyd Perry of the Times of London. Communities in northern Japan are being overwhelmed by radioactive wild boars that are rampaging across the countryside after being contaminated by the Fukushima nuclear disaster. The animals' numbers are increasing as the boar breed, unhindered by the exclusion zone around the stricken Fukushima Daiichi plant, and they are causing damage to farms that are well beyond the area poisoned by radiation. Hunters are shooting the boars as fast as they can, but local cities are running out of burial spaces and incinerator capacity to dispose of the corpses. And let's turn to biological diversity news. Illegal killings drive Mexican wolves into decline in the Southwest. Troubling news out of Arizona and New Mexico. The number of endangered Mexican gray wolves in the wild dropped to 97 last year from 110 in 2014, according to a new census by federal and state biologists. The decline was likely driven by illegal killings of as many as 13 wolves found dead and 11 wolves missing, as well as a low survival rate among dozens of pups born last spring. The center has been on the front lines of the fight to save these wolves, the rarest gray wolves in North America, for years. We have two active lawsuits, one to compel a wolf recovery plan, which the feds have promised to do for more than 30 years, and another to overturn regulations allowing increased killings for these wolves. Mexican gray wolves in the Southwest won't be on a real road to recovery until state and federal agencies step up and do what's needed to help them survive, said the Center for Biological Diversity's Michael Robinson. In a settlement, feds are to study how Roundup and atrazine harms 1,500 species. The Center for Biological Diversity reached a path-breaking agreement with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The agency will analyze the impacts of atrazine and glyphosate, the two most commonly used pesticides in the United States, on 1,500 endangered plants and species. The next step will be to develop conservation measures to protect endangered species from these chemicals, along with propazine and simazine, which together represent nearly 40% of annual U.S. pesticide use. A series of lawsuits by the Center for Biological Diversity has forced another federal agency, the EPA, to begin the process of analyzing the harms from atrazine and glyphosate by June 2020. The agreement with the Fish and Wildlife Service sets a deadline of December 2022 for the completion of its consultation process. This agreement will result in long overdue protections for our country's most endangered species, said the center's Brett Hartle. Once the Fish and Wildlife Service completes its analysis and the public finally learns just how toxic and deadly these pesticides are to endangered species, we hope that the government will ultimately take most of these products off the shelf. And wildlife officials have okayed the killing of 100 spotted owls in the Klamath National Forest. Federal wildlife officials authorized the U.S. Forest Service to kill up to 103 threatened northern spotted owls in 14 timber sales slated for auction this spring in the Klamath National Forest. The West Side Fire Recovery Project will clear-cut 6,800 acres on slopes above the Klamath River, where lightning fires in the summer of 2014 affected owl habitat reserves. In a new biological opinion, the Fish and Wildlife Service claimed post-fire logging may incidentally take 74 adult owls and 12 to 29 juveniles, but will not jeopardize the continued existence of the forest raptor overall. Natural fires restored the forest after decades of fire suppression and gave spotted owls a kitchen full of food, said the center's Jay Linninger. Owls can thrive with fire, but they cannot survive clear-cutting afterwards. And a report states that 40% of bees, butterflies, and other pollinators are facing extinction. A startling new report finds that 40% of invertebrate pollinator species like bees and butterflies face extinction, while 16% of vertebrate pollinator species like birds and bats are also at risk of disappearing. The report, sponsored by the United Nations, raises serious questions not just about these species, but about our food systems. The study is just the latest to raise alarm bells about the fate of our pollinators, and especially the role pesticides play in their decline. It's no coincidence that pollinator numbers have fallen while industrial-scale use of pesticides have dramatically risen. At some point, the Environmental Protection Agency and the U.S. Department of Agriculture are going to have to hit the pause button on these pesticides until we can figure out how to stop the freefall that our pollinators are in, said Lorianne Bird, director of the Center for Biological Diversity's Environmental Health Program. But she added, the clock is ticking and we need the Obama administration to finally take big, bold action before it's too late. And in our final story, lawsuits have targeted two California mega developments. Developers in California have been busy trying to destroy wildlife habitat, pollute water, reduce air quality, and increase traffic. So the Center for Biological Diversity and allies have been busy trying to stop them. They sued the town of Hesperia for approving the Tapestry development, which proposes to bring 16,000 housing units and 1.4 million square feet of commercial space to the San Bernardino Mountains and high deserts. A few days before that, the center sued the Southern California city of Moreno Valley over initiatives meant to shield the World Logistics Center, a 40 million square foot warehouse project, from environmental challenge. That project would add 14,000 daily truck trips, worsen already poor air quality, and harm birds and other wildlife in the nearby San Jacinto wildlife area. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for Biological Diversity News and the Earth First Update this week. Please tune in to Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3 tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock for a rebroadcast of this program. You can also listen to Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho on KRFP 90.3 FM at 3 p.m. on Wednesdays. Truth and Justice Radio, heard on WZBC in Boston, Massachusetts, 90.3 FM, airs Earth First Update from 6 to 10 a.m. on Sundays. Grateful Dread Public Radio, an internet radio station, airs the Earth First Update at 2 a.m. on Sundays. You can find them at gdprnashville.org. And you can also go to radioforall.net. That's radio, the number, forall.net, where you can listen online or download this or previous versions of the Earth First Update. Please ask your local nonprofit community radio station to air the Earth First Update every week. It's free to download and broadcast. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I want to thank you for listening, and please tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.